preliminary injunction basically says that the EPA can't take further steps in their preemptive process against Pebble.
A federal judge puts a hold on the EPA's process protecting Bristol Bay from the Pebble Mine. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 24th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Governor-elect Walker prepares to take office with help from his transition team delegates.
Yes, I wish the oil wasn't at $75, whatever it is. But, you know, it is. And there's nothing we're going to do about that.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering dental innovations from implants and Invisalign with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
U.S. District Court Judge H. Russell Holland issued a preliminary injunction today temporarily halting the EPA's 404C process regarding the Pebble Mine. The process allows the EPA to restrict or prohibit projects that could have adverse effects on fishery areas. The Pebble Partnership contends the EPA violated the Federal Advisory Committee Act, which ensures advisory committees are objective and accessible to the public while developing the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment. Mike Heatwall is the spokesperson for the Pebble Limited Partnership.
The preliminary injunction basically says that the EPA can't take further steps in their preemptive process against Pebble until the merits of this case have more time in front of the court.
The EPA initiated the 404C process at the end of February, alleging the Pebble Mine would have significant and irreversible negative impacts on the Bristol Bay watershed. Trout Unlimited's Tim Bristol says the ruling is disappointing.
The people of the region, the people who depend upon that fishery for their livelihood, I think after last week's announcement of a potential huge run, I think they were hopeful that we would have the Clean Water Act protections in place. So for the first time in over a decade, they could go out there and fish and operate their businesses and get on with their lives and not have the specter of Pebble looming over their head.
Bristol says today's ruling likely means Judge Holland needs more time to sort through the information filed by the Pebble Partnership. The EPA says it's waiting to see the court's written order on the preliminary injunction and hopes the litigation is resolved quickly so the agency can move forward with its regulatory decision-making. Court proceedings are expected to resume early next year. Governor-elect Bill Walker and his transition team held meetings in Anchorage over the weekend to hammer out a list of priorities for the incoming administration. The 250 committee members, stakeholders from across the state, discussed topics ranging from fiscal policy to subsistence. It was a rare attempt for an incoming administration to shape its future so openly. KSKA Zachariah Hughes reports.
Each of the 17 committees produced notes that will be compiled into reports and shared with the public. The reports will also be used by the governor and his staff as the starting point for policy revisions as the new administration takes over. Rick Halford is one half of the Walker transition team and offered closing remarks emphasizing the influence the weekend's discussions will have on the incoming administration.
This is a listening process, and the question has been asked, what's the product? The product is you and the relationships you've built in that report. And it is not intended to stop here. It's intended to go on.
The meetings were open to the public and represent an effort to bring as many voices as possible from different parts of the state into the transition process. Malcolm Roberts was part of Governor Wally Hickel's transition team in 1990 and says back then a group of 20 advisors met behind closed doors.
It was only a very small group of people involved. This is a whole new world.
The crowd at the meeting's closing session was as diverse as the agenda, with men in suits sitting knee-to-knee with women holding parkies with sunshine ruffs, and plenty in between. Anna Hoffman, the other head of the transition team, read off conclusions offered earlier in the day from the various commissions.
We should identify best practices and utilize tribal structures to capture the values in our state. We will achieve sustainability by being conservation-minded. We need to reverse negative trends to populate our training facilities and not our holding facilities. We all agree to put fish first, and we know that the low-hanging fruit can sustain us.
The air of optimistic camaraderie was undercut by the pessimistic financial outlook for the state and conversations earlier in the weekend about lean budgets in the year ahead. Walker told the crowd his campaign's motto of diversity creating unity will be fundamental to his administration's approach to finding economic solutions.
And yes, I wish the oil wasn't at $75 or whatever it is, but you know, it is. And there's nothing we're going to do about that ourselves. We're going to work our way out of this because we're Alaskans. And there'll be some changes. You bet there will be.
Two of those changes have already been announced as Walker's team has picked two new commissioners for his cabinet. Mark Myers will replace Joe Balash at the Department of Natural Resources, and Randall Hoffback has been chosen to head the Department of Revenue, a position currently held by Angela Rodell. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
It is estimated that 1,800 undocumented Mexicans are living in Alaska, although there is no account of how many undocumented immigrants of other nationalities may be in the state. Now, some undocumented immigrants may be eligible for an expanded deferred action program announced last week by President Barack Obama. The president's executive order may not become official anytime soon, according to the Immigration Justice Project's Robin Bronin. Bronin says there are few details, and it could be 6 months before applications are available. But she cautions undocumented immigrants who could qualify should start gathering proof of identification now.
This is a program to make sure that the people who are living here, who are contributing to our community, have immigration documents so that they can get, for instance, driver's licenses and not be afraid when they're taking their children to school that they're going to be deported from the United States.
The president's plan does not grant undocumented immigrants citizenship, but it does expand an earlier program aimed at keeping illegal immigrant children in the U.S. The earlier Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals plan helped this Anchorage woman who arrived in Alaska illegally at age 13. She spoke through a translator.
I'm very happy because I'm not anymore afraid of driving. And I can go to work, and I can keep my family together.
The president's action is intended to allow undocumented parents of immigrant children born in the U.S. to remain in the country legally, and it frees federal immigration authorities to target criminals and those undocumented immigrants recently arrived in the U.S. for deportation. There has been some new activity at Mount Shishaldin. The Alaska Volcano Observatory upgraded the volcano to an orange status several months ago. But as AVO geologist Chris Way-Thomas says, Shishaldin started acting differently Sunday night.
We detected an escalation in seismic activity that suggested that the volcano had gotten, you know, had increased its level of unrest significantly over what it's been for the last several months.
Way-Thomas says there has been no ash emission thus far from Shishaldin, but that volcano is known for producing huge ash plumes as high as 20,000 feet.
There are some very strong thermal signals detected at the summit, suggesting that there may have been some emission of hot material blocks or flows or something on the upper flanks.
Shishaldin is one of the most active volcanoes in Alaska. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, searching for hidden art in Anchorage.
Here's one marshmallow, and you're a marshmallow, and you see this thing, and it's pretty cool.
Sound strange? We'll explain.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
A few weeks ago, police were called to the Kanakanak Hospital in Dillingham when a woman 6 months pregnant and a mother who had just given birth that day were caught smoking oxycodone pill in the bathroom of the maternity room. The disturbing incident highlighted just how severe the use of opioids like heroin and oxycodone has become in Bristol Bay. Now the hospital has made the testing for opioids routine for all pregnancies. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Here's how a 30-something adult woman described to me her recent withdrawal from heroin use after she voluntarily checked into a hospital to detox.
You're sweating, you're shaking, you're having mad panic attacks, you're nauseated, your stomach is cramping, you get really bad restless legs. I mean, I was thrashing, like they were worried about like my IV. They thought I was going to like tear it out because I was like kicking the bed and laying on the floor.
She said the first
3-4 days were hell.
And added that the withdrawal was so bad it will be her biggest motivating factor to stay clean from here on out so she never has to go through it again. When pregnant mothers use heroin or other opioids like oxycodone, their unborn children can become equally as dependent. And when they're born and separated from the narcotics in the mother's blood, they too can go into withdrawal.
The symptoms are kind of like withdrawal in adults, except you've got tiny, tiny children who can't speak and can't do anything to tell you what's wrong.
That's Dr. Kathy Heineman, a physician at the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation's Kanakanak Hospital in Dillingham. She's describing neonatal abstinence syndrome, the term for babies born with a dependence to the opioid drugs used by their mothers. The symptoms, when they begin to appear just days after birth, aren't pretty.
The symptoms can be high-pitched crying, excessive crying, fever, diarrhea, irritability, poor feeding. That's probably one of the more important things with a tiny newborn is that they need to eat every couple of hours anyway. And if you have a kid that is so irritable that they can't even eat, then that can be a life-threatening problem for them.
Severe withdrawal from opioids can also cause newborns to have seizures, which can also be life-threatening. But aside from life-threatening, consider that the infant is going through a pain that brings adults to their knees. Heroin users say it's the start of withdrawal that keeps them addicted, not some euphoric high. How and where these children are cared for during that period of intense suffering concerns Dr. Heineman.
I think a more worrisome problem is that if a child is born to a mother who is using, and the child goes through withdrawal, and you have a mother that is still using, is the mother paying sufficient attention to that child?
Better, she says, to keep the infant in the hospital under the same care as adults who come to detox.
Stays of a week or two are fairly common for infants that are going through a lot of withdrawal. And yes, if the withdrawal is severe enough, they do give the child morphine or methadone.
With the increased abuse of heroin and oxycodone in the region, the Kanakanak Hospital now tests all expectant mothers for opioids during routine prenatal care, beginning with their first visit.
We have decided that part of good care would be to know. We want mothers to be healthy. We want babies to be healthy. If we know that a mother's having problems with drugs, we want to help them. To be honest, I'm not exactly sure what form that help is going to take at the moment, but knowledge is power, and if we have that knowledge, we want to support them in their pregnancy to be the healthiest that they can.
Dr. Heineman stresses that there's no shame attached to the test, that it's done for all expectant mothers the same as HIV testing, which was controversial when it was first made routine. Beyond the initial withdrawal, what effects heroin use during pregnancy can have on the child's brain and development or future susceptibility to heroin use as an adult are not well studied. For Dr. Heineman, she's afraid too many women really don't yet know how harmful drug use during pregnancy may be to their child. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Predicting storms in a fast-changing environment is not easy, but the National Weather Service is slowly working on a plan to improve their forecasts in Alaska and across the country by adding in the view from the ground. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
Since he moved to Unalaska 12 years ago, Dale Miller has weathered a lot of storms, but nothing like the one he calls the doozy.
I had a new Colorado out in the front yard that I watched go on two wheels that leaned over and it slid about 4 inches.
That's exactly what Miller wanted to avoid when the tail end of a super typhoon swept into the Bering Sea this month. Miller is a mechanic with a lot of spare materials and cars laying around.
Kind of wanted to park things in a way where maybe the glass isn't going to get broken. But I didn't know which direction the wind was going to be coming from if it did hit.
That information was available in a string of alerts from the National Weather Service. But even though they're meant for the public, meteorologist Dave Snyder says they're not always user-friendly.
Warning and advisory and watch, are those types of words helpful to you or are they confusing?
Those questions are at the heart of the Weather Ready Nation project. Over the last 3 years, Snyder and other forecasters have been trying to get the country better prepared for storms. That includes putting out effective warnings. And research has shown that most people don't understand the different terms that the National Weather Service has relied on. If there's an exception, it might be coastal Alaska, where commercial fishermen and recreational boaters rely on forecasts to navigate, so they learn to speak the language. But weather is a critical part of life on land, too. In Unalaska, Snyder says the terrain is full of hills and valleys that can channel wind into strong, localized gusts.
If the wind's blowing one direction and it happens to make it down the canyon and into town just right, well, that might hit a container. Or if it's blowing a different way, it might hit the crane.
That's exactly what happened 5 years ago. The same storm that picked up Dale Miller's truck also knocked down a cargo crane at Unalaska's port. It's a pretty extreme example, but weather can affect port operations on a smaller scale, like when shipping companies try to figure out when it's safe to offload cargo. Snyder visited Unalaska last week to see how weather drives some of those decisions on the ground.
Those kinds of things are really important. Anytime there's damage, even from a little bit of weather, we'd like to know about that so we know how this particular weather situation impacted your daily life.
That's where a new crop of Weather Ready Nation ambassadors will come in. Snyder is helping recruit volunteers who can explain how their communities respond to storms. Eventually, it could lead to a new kind of forecast, one that clearly lays out how traffic or shipping might be affected by the day's weather in language that's easy to understand. For Dale Miller, that can't come soon enough. The mechanic tried to windproof his property in Unalaska, but the big storm he was expecting this month mostly blew out to sea.
So it's all good. I just think that there's one coming for us out there. And that's the one that's going to ruin our day pretty good.
Whatever the form, it won't come without a warning. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
The interior is forecast to get a little snow over the next couple of days, but as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the trend is for continued dry weather.
Less than an inch of snow is forecast for the central and eastern interior through Wednesday, far from enough to turn around Fairbanks' otherwise snowless November. That doesn't surprise National Weather Service Alaska Region Climate Sciences and Services Manager Rick Toman, who tracks broader patterns influencing the state.
The flow aloft has been out of the south, which means areas to the lee of significant mountain ranges are dry. And we've also had a lack of Bering Sea storms this fall, which has helped contributed to much of western Alaska being dry.
Toman issued a long-range forecast Friday. He anticipates warmer than normal temperatures to continue across much of Alaska, except the northeastern portion of the state.
The Brooks Range down into the eastern interior may not share in that warmth, at least for the whole month. But for the winter as a whole, all of Alaska tilts towards significantly warmer than normal.
The long-range outlook does not include much snow for the interior.
Precipitation follows kind of a Chinook-type pattern with southerly winds aloft. That would bring, over a several-month period, significantly above normal precipitation to the eastern Gulf of Alaska coast, Kenai Peninsula area. But as those southerly winds blow across the coastal mountains and then the Alaska Range, those are drying winds for the interior.
Toman stresses that long-range forecasting is based on computer models that aren't all in agreement. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
A new report says the Forest Service is wasting millions of dollars by propping up a failing Southeast Alaska timber industry. It says the Tongass National Forest should instead invest in projects supporting tourism and fishing, which are growing segments of the economy, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Headwaters Economics, a Montana-based research firm, prepared the report with funding from two conservation-oriented foundations. It was released by the Alaska chapter of Trout Unlimited, which is critical of Tongass logging.
The Tongass has historically been a national forest focused on old-growth harvesting, and it looks very much today like the same thing.
Ben Alexander is Headwaters Associate Director.
The underlying economics in Southeast Alaska have shifted radically, and the growth sectors and the sectors creating jobs and opportunities for communities and businesses now are no longer in timber.
The report says the Forest Service spent more than $100 million over the past 5 years subsidizing old-growth logging. Alaska Regional Forester Beth Pendleton didn't have the information at hand to confirm or deny that figure. But she says Congress, not her office, decides how much money goes to programs such as timber, fishing, and tourism.
I believe that the report, while well-intentioned, is flawed, and I think it shows some naivete relative to how the federal budgets are allocated.
In 2010, the Forest Service committed to moving from old growth to younger growth harvests in the Tongass. Trout Unlimited Alaska Policy Director Austin Williams says the agency has moved too slowly.
It's frankly not clear when that time frame might start or end. And there's an opportunity to speed it up. 10 to 15 years is just too long, and it's not getting at the real needs of Southeast Alaska communities.
The Forest Service says a change this big doesn't happen overnight. Pendleton says the planning process is ongoing, including consulting with an advisory committee representing different interest groups.
The planning process takes time. It's one that's based on collaborative engagement with our communities and publics, and also through the offering of stewardship contracts. So these things do take some time, but we're making some progress in that direction.
A separate report from an industry consultant and an environmental scientist says the transition could happen in 5 years. The Forest Service says that's not realistic, but Pendleton says that research is part of the advisory committee's discussion. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
Frost is one of Anchorage's newest public art projects. It's a scavenger hunt with photo clues that lead you to a place where the artists have mixed lights and film into a temporary art piece. It's called Creative Placemaking and aims to get people out into the city's parks and help them see the space in a different way. KSKA's Ann Hillman teamed up with some seekers and followed the clues to find the newest installation.
Listeners, beware. This story may spoil your search. So if you're hoping to find the hidden art exhibit completely on your own, turn off your radio for the next 3.5 minutes, or plug your ears, or just start singing really loudly. We're off on our quest to find the Frost.
Hi, I'm unnaturally telling my name into the microphone.
Let's try this again.
My name is Crystal Garrison.
Crystal had heard about Frost and let me tag along on her expedition to find it. She roped her fiancé, Corey Crawford, into the outing, and their trusty dog, Leo. The first stop was inside, at the computer, to look up the clue on the Frost website.
So I just Googled Anchorage Frost.
You got Frost Dental, so I guess we can go get our teeth
There's
cleaned.
Dr. John D. Frost.
With a more refined search, we find the first clue, a picture of a snowy lawn with towering lights. In the distance, you can see a blurry fence and a dark area on the edge.
I would have a hard time guessing on this picture, to be honest with you.
But Corey knew it instantly.
I think that's
He's super visual.
The duck pond's right here. The parking lot is right in front of it.
Corey says it makes sense because the park is easily accessible by car, bus, bike, and foot, but people don't always think to hang out there. Gretchen Weiss is one of the project coordinators. She says the five exhibits will be placed in different parks in the city for short periods throughout the winter.
Anchorage is huge, and we've got
over 200 parks, and each one has its own flavor and variety. And so we kind of took the personality of what that frost was going to be like, and we looked at what the parks were like, and we kind of matched them up.
This time, the Frost exhibit is a short film made from footage gathered around the world. So the setting has a more classic cinematic feel. Weiss says the temporary outdoor exhibits invite people to interact with strangers that they may never otherwise meet.
For frost, it's dark, and people are wearing lots of layers, so you really don't have a whole lot to go off of somebody, except for here's one marshmallow, and you're a marshmallow, and you see this thing, and it's pretty cool, and you can start talking when maybe usually you wouldn't.
When we arrive at to look for the movie, the park is empty, despite the relatively warm weather. Leo the dog leads the way. As we enter the park, Corey finds the scene of the clue.
You remember seeing the rock in the picture?
Oh, no, I don't.
These rocks were in the picture. That's the duck pond to the left.
Leo bounds ahead and we follow.
Oh. You totally called it.
We find the film projected from a locked box onto a white wooden board. Extension cords trail away from the setup. Crystal watches the film outside in the cold. She's impressed.
This is so awesome that you're bringing art to the public and you're leaving it out there for people to explore and discover on their own, whether they're meaning to or not. But it's also got to be kind of nerve-wracking to leave this equipment and this art and, you know, all the time spent involved setting it up. You know, it's just kind of a... Hopefully people will enjoy it for what and how it is and not feel the need to tamper with it.
Crystal's statement turned out to be prophetic. Within a week of our successful quest, cords began to disappear, and the setup had to be altered to make it more secure. But Weiss says they'll try to keep it running until December 6th, when they'll reveal the final location and host a drive-in movie at Okay, I'll give you another clue. It's that big building in Midtown where you can go to read for free. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hellman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Dan Hillman in Anchorage, Thea Card and Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska Laborers Local 71 and the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities ask you to slow down in construction zones while they work to keep roads safe. Alaska Laborers Local 71, working hard for Alaska. This message is sponsored by Alaska Laborers Local 71.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.